Good evening. Okay, good evening, everybody. It's Wednesday night, and this is Life in the Labyrinth. We are now in Chapter 2 as we study the book Life in the Labyrinth by E.J. Gold. So I'd like to welcome everybody to this evening's festivities. Okay. And Ivan, I got a little confused. I didn't know which book to bring.
Oh, so you brought the American Book of the Dead?
I got confused.
Oh, okay.
As to which one we were studying tonight.
Oh, I see.
But we'll get into that later.
Is that a demonstration of lack of maze brightness? Or?
We'll see.
Okay.
Or maybe it was maze brightness.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So, anyway, Chapter 2 is, as Ivan indicated, it's called Maze Brightness. And I'm reading from the new edition, and Ivan, you have the older edition there. So, to begin with, I think it's important that you take a second here and just pay attention to what we're doing. Pay attention for a moment to being in the class for just a moment. We're going to be here for such a short period of time, and then the class will be gone. So for that moment and that short period of time, come here. Come to the class. Okay? Good. Good. Thank you. So, Ivan, do you want to get us started and read the header to the chapter?
Okay. Chapter 2, Maze Brightness. When we awaken a higher learning process, we no longer exhibit confusion and disorientation in the macro dimensions. Through special internal processes, which we can learn, we are able to penetrate far beyond the ordinary spectrum into the macro dimensions, resembling consensus reality in form, but radically different in other ways, perceivable only with long, difficult training of the non-machine attention.
That's a mouthful. But it's set forth here and it's placed before us as an invitation. It's an invitation as to something that we are able to do. It is not it's not by accident that we specifically are here, or that you listening to this whenever you listen to it are in fact listening to it. So take a moment and let's get into this chapter. We're going to unravel it a bit, and let's see what we come up with, okay?
All right.
Okay, I'm going to jump ahead just a couple of paragraphs, and where the author goes, this is the last paragraph on this first page, where it starts out, "I discovered, independently of texts on behavioral sciences, something which I later learned was by convention called maze brightness, which could be defined for the moment as being able to find new paths through the maze toward the reward point through sheer repetition." And jumping ahead slightly in that paragraph, "eventually becoming aware of the general rules of maze construction. I discovered through this a special learning process." And I pose the question to all of us here, what will that special learning process be? By the end of this chapter, and certainly by the end of the book, can you declare what that special learning process is? In a certain way, it's mysterious, it's wondrous. On the other hand, it's right before us. Okay? Special learning process where we can know a maze, any maze, and know how what those general rules of maze construction might be. I also concluded, probably rightly, that such a rat would eventually, having blundered its way through a sufficient number of mazes, in spite of itself, begin to dimly recognize the inescapable fact that it is in a maze, and that, moreover, it cannot, at least by present means, remove itself to parts unknown. So in order for this to work, in order for this process to begin, we have to have a sense of the fact that we are in a maze, and in a sense, I don't know how to put it other than that. We were locked in a certain way to where we normally always are. We're locked into that. The key here is calling it, naming it, and becoming aware of that fact, carrying it around. What does it feel like on your shoulders when you are in a sense, in the maze part of it, when you are locked into that? Conversely, what does it feel like? What is your sensitivity telling you when you are not locked into that maze? Once again, we're talking about different shades of self-awareness, and in particular right now, the subtleties of the sensing mechanism. Okay? Does this make sense, Ivan?
Yeah, it does, except that I'm not so certain that it's a matter of not being locked into the maze. I mean, is it, you know what I mean? The maze brightness has to do with solutions, or threading through, or understanding, knowing how to face any maze at all, and so on. But it doesn't have to do with getting out of a maze, does it?
Well, yes, it does.
Oh, okay. All right, well, let's continue.
As long as we're in that maze and don't even have a sense that we're in the maze, there's no compare and contrast.
Yeah.
So let's see what we uncover as the chapter goes on then, okay? Once this first all-important recognition has been achieved, without which nothing further is possible, so just that's a starting point. That's a key starting point. Now I'm going to jump to the next paragraph. Because the perceptual emotional conflict will have, for the moment, be resolved, it will no longer exhibit the compulsion to maintain a self-constructed veil of confusion and disorientation. Why is the author saying that? What is being said there? What's being implied? So we recognize something.
Well, you want to ask Molly if we got any comments over there?
And let's. Pardon? We're doing it to ourselves. That's correct. That's right. That's right,
veil.
Mark. It's a self-constructed veil, and we hide there. We go there. But once we pop out of it, that constraint and that duality just dissipates. And then to let's jump ahead a couple of paragraphs. I'm at the top of page 11. At the same time, one can see visible signs of excitement as a new sense of freedom descends overwhelmingly upon us, the same sense of freedom which humans have discovered, which they called the enlightenment experience. Of course, for humans, this first glimpse of real freedom, not from the maze, but from the self-induced boundaries, purely psycho-emotional limitation, does not last very long. So just note that, that there will be experiences when you pop into that, I don't want to just call it just the waking state, but that you're standing in a sense in a new, this other paradigm. So the waking sense is, the waking state in a sense is the gatekeeper to that. By doing those exercises, we have the ability to step into that new, the new world in a sense. And we'll expand on that as we go through this chapter. And then jumping ahead a few paragraphs, it might be possible to artificially induce maze awareness or brightness and transition into the macro-dimensional space. But we can fully expect that any resulting momentary understanding which may have been gained will almost instantaneously be mangled, mashed, and mauled. Note this phrase down, actually write it down, mauled in the all-devouring jaws of primate convention. Is that a great phrase?
Yeah, yes it is.
And
convention.
And what happens is that, let's say we slide into this idea of the sensing the macro dimension. And I know you know what I mean, the moments of that, what that is. But something grabs you in a sense and pulls you back down into the ordinary. These are not evil forces that are out there. These are not the great demons of blankety blank. What they are is the conventions that we adopt. That we adopt because it's really safe there. Okay? So let's just jump ahead a little bit.
Before we pass that by, David, what would you say, what do you think he's referring to with the to artificially induce maze awareness?
Well,
I mean, is he talking about taking a drug there, or is it about some kind of magic process to invoke somebody's maze brightness, or what would he be talking about?
Well, I think there is a reference to it a few pages ahead, but I consider it things like, let's say that what we decided to do is get together and we chant together, we drum together, we dance together, mm-hmm. things like that. You will go into that space.
Get into an ecstatic state, in other words.
We can get into, let's say, a higher state, and we love that. We embrace that. We say, that's the work. That's spirituality. And this, now the people that are doing it, like some of like maybe these, I think like a Deva Parmal is one woman that is this great chant and things like that. When she's doing it, she herself is working to get into that space. She knows how to get through her maze into that open space. So artificially induced is in a sense saying, if I do these, then I will be in this higher macro dimension. That can occur. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense if artificially induced means external rather than voluntary, mm-hmm. rather than something that I've trained myself to do. Because this is reminding me, I think there was some time during the joy of sacrifice or the human biological machine discussion where I recall, as I am now, this kind of experience that the child guru, Maharaji, I believe it was, laid on people. Like one of my sisters, you know, went to one of these football stadium size, you know, events.
Yeah.
And the child guru was there and he, you know, blessed everyone and vibed them and everything. And yeah, my sister got high as a kite. She said, oh yeah, this changed my state and I got enlightened and so on. But it didn't stay. It faded away in a week and a half.
And
I went back to ordinary life, and so I didn't think it was anything at all.
And that's the point.
That I would call artificial.
That's the point of this particular paragraph.
Yeah.
Where
the
shocky
pot, like artificial, could be, you know,
yeah.
you get hit by the lightning bolt. You know, somebody taps you with the palm frond.
Yeah. So it happens, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if you become addicted to that, then what do you do when it isn't there?
Well, you're not training yourself in any way.
Ah.
I mean, you're...
Is this not the key?
Well, you could be doing... Maybe this... I don't know if in the context of this book, if it's a place to discuss whether you're doing something beneficial or harmful to your nervous system in regard to this work that we're interested in. I mean, you know...
I don't know about that. I just know that... I know that if I go to... Well, I'd have to go to a particular kind of Catholic ceremony. I don't think I can go to the regular.
You mean like an exorcism?
No, I mean like a high Latin mass.
Okay.
You know, like a formally done one. It would invoke, I would enter into a particular space by being in that kind of a ritualistic environment.
Mm-hmm.
But then I go home. What do I do later on Sunday? I go watch the football game, right? Or whatever people do on Sunday.
Sure.
Where did that space go? And what if you desire to get there on Tuesday? So,
only in the church.
So that's what I mean by artificially. I guess I mean the external inducement of it. I believe it's possible. So, jumping ahead then a few paragraphs, it's to the paragraph starting, when we have developed. Oh, you see
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's 12 in this book.
Okay, and as in this book. We have developed total trustworthiness when we have shown our fortitude and continued enthusiasm in the face of endless repetition, have clearly exhibited signs of unshakable loyalty to the work, successfully separated ourselves from the ways and attitudes of the primate, we have earned the right to become involved in a different type of work, something beyond the primate. So what is meant by unshakable loyalty to the work in this particular context? The next paragraph goes on, this other type of work can only result from serious and concentrated efforts to enter and perform work obligations in macro-dimensional chambers in imaginable domains and to perform such work in ways not at all to the liking of primate directives and biological imperatives. Okay. So all these terms are being introduced. Loyalty to the work, this other type of work, work obligations. What could those mean? Let's take a moment and see what everybody says. Any comments would be appreciated. You know, I don't know is an okay answer to respond.
Right.
Well.
Is it safe there, or is it that we think we are safe there?
The answer is, what do you mean by we? You know, do you mean your human biological machine? The answer is no, it isn't safe there. We haven't started talking about transit yet. There's a transitory moment. We'll get to that in a little while.
Yeah, okay. So let's. How about starting out with the loyalty part?
Okay.
When you asked that question in the first place, what occurred to me is that the in order for you to be responsible, to be able to take obligation, let's say, to do this type of work, it becomes much more, I think, crucial or significant if it's work done in these macro dimensional chambers. And, you know, I'm not sure that I know why or that I could say why here, but I'm going to take that as an assumption. But the so you're going to need to be tested and tested and tested, let's say, for your capability, your competence, your integrity, or whatever. But the loyalty part is, can you be distracted? Can you be, can your attention and your commitment to do this be dissipated by, I want to go like to watch the football game, like you said, or I might have to start an exciting relationship, so I'm going to leave this off and go to town, or you know, in other words, how can you be distracted? Can you be, is money going to distract you, or is romance going to distract you? Is food going to distract you? You know, these are we're talking about primate directives.
The answer is yes.
They are going to distract you.
The answer is yes.
I think
Susan,
I have a comment.
Good. Please.
Well, I think that the loyalty would be to come back even though you've gone to sleep, even though you've gotten caught up in the world, but then you keep coming back.
And I think that's the heart of it right there. You keep coming back. We are apprentices on the path. We're apprentices, we're journeymen, we're learning this craft. We're not saying we are there already. We're saying we're learning this craft. Part of the loyalty is, did you show up? Did you just show up?
Yeah, there's repetition involved. It's like if you're loyal, then eventually you don't get bored. The waking state of the machine, if it's the essence or waking state involved, there's just no boredom. It's boredom is not an option.
Let me is Aria on? Okay, which is what? Yeah, like Aria is saying, so the loyalty, as Susan said, is let's just keep coming back. So I'm always fascinated by somebody like Yo-Yo Ma, the cellist. This fellow has been playing the cello for, 40 years, 35 years, 40 years, something like that, 35. And it's a small instrument, and it's got about 3 feet of keyboard to it. Four strings.
Four strings, yeah.
And a bow. Why isn't he bored? I don't get it. After 10 years or so, it seems like he figured out everything. Why does he keep coming back?
Well, it's loyalty. It's dedication.
Okay, loyalty. It's dedication. Let me ask you a question, Ivan.
Yeah. Okay.
Have you ever... Do you know how to do anything?
I'm pretty good at eating when I get up in the morning.
Okay. Other than your beef store feeding your beef.
Yeah, as you posted for this chapter, I mean, my arts are writing, composition, writing.
Let's stick
music,
with that. Let's stick with that.
Poetry.
Let's go back to poetry.
Eating.
Forget eating.
Okay, we'll put eating aside. All right.
See, it's hard to get Ivan off of eating. I've seen him eat.
An hour. I have to sit here for a whole hour and not think about eating.
It's not a pleasant sight. Anyway, so let's say he's telling us he writes poetry.
My survival is at risk here.
He writes poetry.
Right, okay, I write poetry.
When did you start doing that?
I started doing it as a kid, just out of an impulse. It seemed It seemed like an impulse, or else I imitated
somebody. In a certain way, that doesn't matter.
Yeah, okay.
But it's just to mark a starting point.
Yeah.
Have you ever found any of your poetry from when you were like eight or nine?
Yeah.
How does it, is it pretty good?
It's pretty funny. It's childish stuff.
At the best, it's cute.
Yeah.
Because it's a child. Would you say that the quality of writing was better today than it was 50 years ago?
Of my writing?
Yeah. Of your writing?
Yeah, well, sure.
It goes without saying, right?
Well, there's, what do you call it? Yeah, there's a development, right? There's an accretion. You're in a skill. Okay, you should say this, not me.
In a skill? You learn?
Well, by repetition, and this is part of your answer, actually, I can give you my answer for the Yo-Yo Ma question, the thing is that you even when you seem to be repeating the same thing, it's different every time. It's like if you're dedicated to that art form, craft, let's say skill, talent, form of expression, art form, whatever, career even, it's like you're one of the elements of your integrity is that you're making it new every time for yourself, even if it seems repetitive.
It's a world filled with literally infinite wonder.
Yeah,
infinite wonder.
Yeah.
And Silverdale and I have both read this book a few times.
Yeah, right.
And we've had this conversation a number of times. Why is it different every time? There's a reason. It's brand new every time. It's brand new tonight, chapter 2. So, like for instance, I can juggle passably with three balls. When I first started doing it, and once again, I don't remember how I was attracted to it, but I was quite young.
Yeah.
I was doing all kinds of astronomy. I was making a telescope and stuff. But I started doing this. And guess what happened when I first started trying to juggle with three balls?
Oh, well, it happened to me just the other day when I tried. You dropped them.
You just drop the darn things.
Yeah.
And you get confused. And then for some reason, you do it again, and you do it again. And after a few hundred times, gosh, does it take that long?
Probably. At least.
You wind up being able to
juggle, yeah.
So you went from not being able to do it to it becoming second nature.
Yeah, okay.
It became second nature. How did it become second nature for me to juggle?
Easier to see in that case, let's say, than writing poetry, but it's actually the same process.
It's actually the same.
Which is repetition. There's something, when I sit down to write, there is something, it may be something different that I write every time, but there's a repetition of that activity. There's a repetition for me of what I'm doing.
We have, there's a famous programmer in the audience tonight. And
yes, we have. Yes.
Yeah, very, we won't say his name, because, anyway. And did you go through, is this, describe a little bit about programming? Yeah, he says, yeah. Let me ask you a more complicated question, both of you, about poetry and programming. When you hit a problem and you read a poem that you've written, Ivan, and it just, something doesn't quite right, or you hit it, you do a program and it doesn't quite work like you want it to, how can you find that problem?
Well, there's, how do I say this? There's different minds that you get into, different states, like saying you wear different hats.
Listen carefully.
To find the problem.
Carefully.
I'm not sure how this applies in programming. But
same
you,
way.
Yeah. You have to, let's say, in the process of editing, let's say, in revision, in changing or bettering my own work, I have to imagine myself to be the reader, for example. I have to get in a different space and analyze or appreciate or like understand, appreciate, or comprehend. So that's different than the creative writer, let's say. There's the editorial writer, the revision head, the revision state. You know, and then sometimes you have, again, I don't know if it's true in programming, with, I think it's true in a lot of the arts, sometimes you just have to put something aside and you have to come back to it 3 weeks or 6 weeks or 6 months later, because then you're in a different head, you're in a different place.
And maybe you can find it, the clunk.
Yeah, you need to be, it is like a maze situation. Like you have to do whatever it's necessary to get out of that stuckness, out of that point, that fixation in the maze, out of a dead end. So be able to go somewhere else.
Let's tell me Aria's comment. So, continued enthusiasm in the face of endless repetition. Go ahead. An internal drive, an internal love or compulsion. What? Movement. It calls you back as much as you seek it. Practice, practice, practice.
That's how you get to Carnegie Hall.
Something called commitment to the work from moment to moment, Simon tells us. These are examples. That's what we're looking for. Put them in the log. I'll post the log, but also post them on the site if it's important to you. Wingsofchaos.com, Life in the Labyrinth, Chapter 2. Okay, so what we're talking about, we're trying to answer the question that the author here, E.J. poses this question way back on page 10. I discovered through this a special learning process. Have we got there? How many people do magic tricks, like close-up magic? You know, this is somebody in our audience that he does. So it's like, you know, like, do you do the French drop? Have you ever done the French drop? Are you passable at it? Yeah, he's pretty passable at it, he said. But, and you know when you hit it, right? You know when you hit it. That's what we're talking about. We look at some things outside in ourselves and we go, oh, wow, that's how you do it. Wow, the fact that he did that, that's something. Or here's a writer. Ooh, that's so mysterious. I love the idea that just being a writer, 90% of it is doing it over and over and over again.
That's right. But then there's something that was it Aria, Molly? What did Aria say? And there's something about being called.
Yeah.
Was that statement?
She said, it calls you.
It calls you because, you see, there's
as much as
I think
calls
that
you.
Also... In relation to this work, and I think that we are going to get, EJ is going to get into this in some chapters further on in this book, this idea that comes up over and over again in Rumi, you know, that like the Song of the Reed, which starts out in whatever, the Mahnavi, or one of his long, you know, books of songs or poems, the sound of the reed is, there's the yearning, it's a yearning after completion, the yearning for something that you're separate from, and the yearning to be merged, to be united with it again, is what the Sufi dancer, you know, the Sufi dancer hears in the reed. It's calling you back. It's something that calls you, and I think the idea in that poem, I can't remember the text, but the feeling of it is that the Sufi, the seeker, recognizes the pain of separation, the yearning that the reed feels because it's been cut from the riverside.
Beautiful.
And made into a flute, and the reed plays, and the master player of the ney plays on that reed, and the reed gives forth the sound of pain. pain and separation because it's been cut and taken from the away from its pure side.
Beautiful.
And that's the and then you have the then you have the Sema, you have the Sufi turning. Anyway. But
so
that's calling. That's what I thought of when
calling
when Arya,
and being called.
Yeah. In other words, it's saying the carrot and the stick, like this is the carrot, you know, you're
okay, so
what could keep you coming back to the work for repetitions, let's
so
say.
So mark at this know. Moment there's a feeling of wonder and a sense of ebullience right now. You sense, yes, this is what I want. This is the state I'm talking about, that mystery that I want to be part of. But at the same time, we're warned, a couple of pages back, we're warned of the all-devouring jaws of primate convention. That's the interplay that we work with. That's the interplay. So once Yo-Yo Ma got to a certain state, he was called forever. It's infinite, like Pablo Casals. Just called forever. Rumi couldn't stop writing. He was compelled to do so. But we're not there yet. But we step closer each time to that. And it's practice. So how do we practice? We know a little bit how to practice. We know that already. The Human Biological Machine was a book focused on the human biological machine. And birthed out of that, and I think Silverdale sometimes has some beautiful phrases about what the essential self is birthed out of the human biological machine, and but it's the essential self. Life in the Labyrinth now is about the emergence of the essential self, and that's what we're talking about. We're walking in that world now.
Yeah, I think there's also, I think you're also getting closer to, I think in this book you get at least, what would you say, glimpses or fragments of something that's not addressed, that's only mentioned but not addressed in the human biological machine, which is what is the purpose of awakening the machine, of having the essential self? What is the reason? What is the necessity? What is the obligation once you're in that waking state? What do you do?
Now that is
what
a,
is it for?
That is a mental, I'm sorry, but that's a mental question.
Yeah, right.
I suspend that question. I asked that very early on when I got here. What's the purpose of it?
Yeah.
Well, I asked, let's just say I was challenged a bit. What could I actually understand the purpose? Should I be told that purpose? And could I handle that kind of information? But we can suspend knowing the purpose in that manner, and we can still go forth. But I want to jump ahead a little bit. I'm going to kind of jump around a little teeny bit in the next couple of pages, because I want to get to, an important point for us. And it's right on line with this, what Arya said. So the bottom of page 12, real help is available only to those already well on their way toward non-primate life. You've already voted. Everybody that's here has voted and said, I'm not sure I know how to do it. I don't know if I can handle it, but I want it. I'm voting for that. I'm saying yay. So they voted for being in that, becoming voyagers, courageous voyagers, despite personal fears of the more terrifying aspects of the labyrinth. Yes, they'll show up, and I'm going to mention that in a minute. And they were shown the those people who have shown the potential ability to perform special work under very difficult and overwhelming conditions. You wouldn't be here if there wasn't already a glimmer of that in the work you do. I'm not going to say anybody's name in particular, but there's certain individuals right here who have unique abilities that show up all the time. They show up all the time in those spaces. Now, so, and then jumping ahead, I'm jumping ahead over a bunch of different stuff to the paragraph, underlying it all must be a strong base of natural ability, aptitude, and attitude. Only then can any training and acquired discipline have any lasting value. Aptitude and attitude. So you take somebody like the fine, fine musical group. I think they're on, I'm not sure if they're there, the Dose. But are they there? Obvious aptitude and phenomenal and beautiful attitude. And it just, it's exhibited. Every time they go into that space, they are doing this form of work. Now, using that imprint of how to get to that space, go ahead. It is. Wait, I can't. I need. Can you break it up so I can repeat it?
Yeah. But back to the roomie.
The awful ache.
Well, they're saying we do this piece in a song. They do that.
They do that in
song.
A song. And if they should type in the album that they do it on, if they have it on an album.
The Song of the Reed, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
And what else? What else, Jana?
Okay.
Okay.
That's good. Okay, so aptitude and attitude. You wouldn't have been here for a year of HDM, a year of joy of sacrifice, and now you're here. Okay, so the aptitude is there. The attitude is clearly there. There's nothing, you don't get anything. You don't get a badge or a star or anything by coming to this class. Nothing.
Maybe we could arrange for certificates.
Okay. Navigation, just proceeding ahead, and navigation during active voyaging depends upon a higher learning process, which we call pattern recognition. Yet recognition is impossible unless we can see. Okay?
Oh boy.
Unless we can see.
Yeah, that's one of the keynotes of this book, as I think I said last week.
Fundamental.
I think the author uses the word occlusion, 1,317 times in this book.
And we're occluded. Now,
you wonder. To do with not seeing, yeah.
You wonder why I brought the copy of the American Book of the Dead.
Oh, there you go.
Because I get confused between the two books. They're about the same thing. They're about the voyager. Now, I'm just going to read something from a particular chamber. Let me see if I can find it real quick. This is the seventh chamber. What? Okay. In an Eastern Rose Garden. Thank you very much, Molly.
Name of the album.
Okay, so now I'm going to read a paragraph from the seventh chamber of the American Book of the Dead. The brilliant red dissolving radiation explodes out of the heart of the beloved, penetrating my being. And alongside that explosive red radiation is another light, the soft yellow pathway leading to the dimension of hungry ghosts. They who are never satisfied. That's the dilemma that we face. We are faced with the cleansing radiation of the macro dimension. And the exit sign is always there. The exit sign is always there. The soft yellow light. Or whatever it might be.
Whichever chamber it is and whatever the colors are and so on, there's always some kind of comfort involved. Molly says when you're out of your body, you want to go to the strongest, the solar radiation, which is what you don't want when you're in your body.
That's the difficulty that we have. The opportunity that the cleansing radiation provides to us. It literally is a karmic cleanser. But it hurts.
Yeah, right. So that's going to take attitude there. It's not just after. This is where some of the attitude comes in, right? You have to have an attitude, an orientation of what your goals are, what you're aiming for to stay in those radiations. I mean, over and over again in the Book of the Dead, the deal is don't go into a nice, comfortable house. Don't jump into a bush to hide.
Right.
Don't hide behind a rock or a tree. Don't shelter yourself. Don't shield yourself.
We can't hear you.
Yeah.
So say it again. Yeah, Molly is saying that when you build your character, you protect it from the radiation, the deadly radiation. And then when it's time to, it is life force, but it is deadly feeling to the maze conception we have of ordinary life. We are leaving the world of the ego dance into a different world. And at that point, the essential self can get cleansed, and there's a chance for something new and different at that moment. A certain higher intelligence can be acquired in the macro dimensions. This human primate intelligence is all but useless, because it only refers to the life of the human biological machine. I thought about that for a while. I thought, well, really what it is that we are standing here in a maze of our own premises, and we sit here with our premises, and we won't and don't want them to be questioned. So when we allow ourselves over the line, they're questioned. They're substituted. It's a different fundamental point of view, and that's the difference between standing in the human biological machine and being and living from the essential self. You'll be surprised throughout your day. You will get surprised. Sometimes it'll be a color. I did a thing for a while. I carried these little Bardo cards around with me. And you start seeing things in a different way altogether. You're surprised by suddenly it's a yellow day, or there's a lot of confusion, or it's fast, or it's slow. And you start to notice, in that sense, the macro dimension. But you have to practice it. You practice transitioning from where you are to being able to get there. And there's an inner mechanism, and we did talk about this in HCM, where you navigate in part through mood. You don't navigate through a mental mechanism. You find your way there. You find your way there. And when you're there, you kind of know you're there. You do know you're there. And it rings true. And for everybody in this space, it rings true also, because it's an objective space that you wind up in.
There is.
Go ahead.
Is there something anybody posted, Molly? I was going to say, is it this statement? Human primate intelligence is all but useless because it only refers to the life of the human biological machine. This reminds me of an exercise that EJ used to give out. I think it may be an autobiography of a Sufi, but it's where you take and you just look at any ordinary object like this cup here, or even at or look at my own hand, and you forget about your ordinary relationship with that and your definition of it, and you think of five different other possibilities for what that is. And what is that exercise about? That exercise is about freeing up your attachment to the totally primate, you know, a fixation on meaning being only what you're habituated to.
Go ahead, Molly, and then I'm going to repeat him. So. You are still, Simon says, you may win the rat race, but you're still a rat. Good, nice. Very good. Before they go into Satori, Mark says, people usually at the point. Where there's they realize that there's an infinity of possible points of view. Yeah. The boat has left the dock.
Yeah, right. And you can.
Yeah, so Arya had that experience of seeing the world in that way when they were less fettered by being grown up as much. Bardo Band-Aid. Okay.
Bardo Band-Aid?
Yeah.
All right.
So, there's a kind of a tough example about keeping your head in these difficult spaces. It's an external example, but it kind of works. It's said that people who are elite bodyguards, you know, very high-end bodyguards, they go through rigorous training to keep their head when they're extremely dangerous situations. And one exercise they run these guys through is they'll run them into like a house or something, corridors, and they'll unexpectedly, they'll have to turn a corner. And unknowns to them when they're going to do it, they'll be shot with a paint gun pellet.
Oh, this is,
they're being trained as elite bodyguards. I don't know if you've ever been shot with a paintball. I have. It leaves a huge black and blue. It really hurts. But the object is, even if that occurs, can they still do their job? Even if that distraction at that level occurs, can you still do your job? Some people I know can. The filters work in such a way. And what is that filter? Right now the filter is human biological first, no matter what. Gradually the balance changes so that the essential self becomes the leader. And the essential self is the infinity of what is around us, the voidness of the void. We allow ourselves to immerse ourselves in at that moment. That's the guide. That becomes what we serve, not any individual or any particular moment. Practice. And the better you get at it, the more demanding the practice is. Okay? We're kind of, you know, getting toward the end here, but just, you know, like, patterning is a natural part of our perception, but pattern recognition depends entirely on our ability to eliminate occlusion, to accept larger and larger perceptual, informational, topological field structures. Can we see it from yet a different and different point of view? Not necessarily anthropocentric. And then, you know, UJ goes on to talk about shamanism. That's the practice. We make these things mysterious. Oh, the person's a shaman. Oh, wow. Well, great. The guy's a shaman or she's a shaman. Yeah, whatever it is. Doesn't matter. The matter is, can you do your work right now to get into that same space? It's an objective space. If they're doing their work in a proper manner, and they are because they know how to navigate that part of the labyrinth and get out of the human biological machine, then you will find them there if you're in that space. Guaranteed. But what's not guaranteed is our practice of getting there. The more we can get there, the more we can begin to fulfill the possibility of whatever is meant way back at the beginning here, where he talks about work obligation. What a phrase. Perform work obligation. My goodness. Like, let's say you were a cellist and they said, oh, I need someone to fill in at the LA Philharmonic. I don't think I can do it. But if you practice in a certain way, you can step into there. When the event calls you forth, you can therefore be there. What I'm talking about is something we can do every single day. Every day, several times or many times during the day. I'm in a reading cycle right now because some very dear friends passed and need some reading. And I still notice that when I go to approach the reading cycle, I have a fear. What is that fear? What's the fear that I have? Why do I have that?
Beyond some boundary or other, huh? Going beyond some boundary.
I'm afraid to leave the human biological machine and go into the world where I know where I'm going to be. I know where I'm going to wind up. And once I get there into that space, I'm awash in it. I'm awash in that space. And what I attempt to do is carry that with me through the rest of the day. So I'm given a gift, a platform to hold my toes on that I can keep. And if I can keep that for the rest of the day, haven't I then given a possibility to those around me? And maybe see that space also.
If you can carry it with you.
If I can carry it with me. But I have to recognize both sides of the conundrum, don't I? it's an interesting closing paragraph. And I'll just go ahead and read it. But there is no doctorate of labyrinthology in our universities, although a medieval university might have issued one. Our present well-destructive technocratic culture has become so wholly alienated from the living world that it fears any exploration outside the realm of the agro-industrial military complex and a possible mass exodus into unknown and economically useless macro dimensions. Such fears are not unusual among robotic government agencies and have found fertile soil in just about all established cultural power holders in the world. This is the world of the human biological machine. We have chosen, as I've said many times, to take our ship and move our sails and tack in a different way. We've gone on a different path. But know where you are. In a sense, as we were talking about at dinner, in a certain way, we're in enemy territory. And we, as we did say, we can establish a beachhead. become more comfortable with getting to that beachhead, and comfortable, just as important as staying in it and sensing it and being in it and see what it feels like while you're in it.
Well, yeah, how about that phrase, a living world? That's a good one.
That's a living world. Then
it's living world is the antithesis to all of this primate.
Then it's a living world, and the living world is always imbued with wonder. Imbued with wonder, and we keep coming back to it every time. The thing of beauty. So do you want to, anything else that we need to read before we can... Send the log, please. Yes.
We do.
No, we remember them. Yeah. Things like the real world catalog. Those are all products that we put out over the years. And
help. Help. The help desk. Where help is, where help is available.
Yeah.
Bardomania. It was like the weapon shops, you know, a Bardomania shop was like a weapon shop of issue, you know, Van Vogt's science fiction novel. What about this end piece here, David?
And, yep, and I think we're ready for that then.
At the end of chapter two, the author writes, if I tell you the meaning, your mind will follow the meaning. As attention follows mind, you won't get the meaning.
Think on those things. It becomes clear if you look at it for a few minutes. So thank you for coming. Thanks to our guests.
Thank you all.
And we look forward to seeing you next week on Wednesday at 7 o'clock, we'll be on Chapter 3. Give it a read. Make some comments on the site if you'd like to. Share some of your insights with each other. It's wingsofchaos.com, Life in the Labyrinth, and it's Chapter 2.
Harry Lundell posted on there for the first chapter.
Yeah, and then Ivan
posted
just on Chapter 2. And I'll have Chapter 3 up in the next, probably by tomorrow sometime. Thanks for coming, and good evening.